This is The Lack with Nina Power and Benjamin Studebaker. Today we're doing Breaking Away, and I'll kick us off. Breaking Away came out in 1979. It stars Dennis Christopher as Dave Stoller, a teenager in Bloomington, Indiana. Dave's father was a stonecutter before the quarries closed. Deprived of his honest living, Dave's father became a used car salesman. To scrape by, he's forced to sell cars he knows to be lemons. He'd like his son to do something better with his life, but he's far too proud to say this out loud. What is Dave to do, anyway? All the jobs available to him are crummy service jobs. They're a lot of work for not much money. He could go to college, but that's never been the way in his family. The university students disdain the local working class kids, derisively referring to them as cutters. It's a play on the stone-cutting jobs their parents had, jobs that they themselves will never get to do. Dave's friends have run-ins with the college kids. They get into fights and competitions over little things. Dave and his friends promise to stick together. Even if they have to waste their lives, they won't give in to the system. But you can already tell that underneath their bravado, they're wavering. They know they can't avoid the labor market forever. Sooner or later, their parents will make them get jobs. Dave retreats from this harsh reality into the fantasy that he is Italian. He's learned that Italian families stick together, that multiple generations often live in the same house. He believes that while the Italians are poor, they're happy. He learns Italian, plays Italian music, and even greets his father with "Buongiorno, Papa." He takes up cycling, imagining himself one day joining a European cycling team. His mother is supportive, but his father becomes increasingly frustrated with his son. This frustration is expressed through a hostility to all things Italian, even zucchini. But Dave won't abandon his dreams. He even impersonates an Italian foreign exchange student to get a date with a sorority girl. When his father forces him to work on the used car lot, Dave perseveres with his training, even into the middle of the night. Eventually, an Italian cycling team visits Bloomington to compete in a bicycle race. Dave enters the race, hoping to impress the Italians. But when he proves he can keep up with them, they sabotage his bike. Injured physically and emotionally, Dave loses heart. He stops speaking Italian. He comes clean with his girl. He's so visibly depressed, even his father feels bad for him. But Dave is intent on getting serious now, and that means he'll have to sit the college entrance exam and try to be normal like everyone else. He manages to put up a good score, and he'll enter the university next year. But first, he has some unfinished business. His friends have managed to get entered into the Little 500, the famous bicycle race that takes place at Indiana University in April of each year. Dave is their ringer, and with him on the pedals, they can't lose. Dave builds up a big lead, but midway through the race, Dave crashes. That forces each of his friends to take turns substituting for him. Eventually, they prop him back up on the bike, tape his feet to the pedals, and pray he can finish the race. As it turns out, he not only finishes the race, he wins it. The team of working-class boys beats all the teams from the fraternities. It's a heartwarming film, precisely because it's so clear that this is the end of the line for the boys. When fall comes, they'll have to part ways. The film ends with Dave enrolled at the university, chatting up a French foreign exchange student. Through the university system, Dave will be okay, because it's 1979. And in 1979, if you could get into school, things would work out. This film almost made me cry, because as bad as things were then, they're far worse now. The humiliation suffered by the father, as he was pushed out of the respectable stone-cutting job, and into a job that forced him to lie and cheat to survive, is now suffered by everyone, including all the young people who try to live honestly, who go to college and do what they're told. It is a humiliation that is on a long march through the institutions, into every field and every part of human life. It's a stripping of the dignity of people. As I watched this film, I was often struck by the reasonableness of Dave's retreat into the fantasy of being Italian. This dishonesty was the only way he could stay honest. It was only as a fake Italian that he could live in accordance with his values, that he could be, even for a brief interval, the slightest bit happy. It was chaotic, but it was beautiful. I see many young people these days engaged in similar kinds of fantasies about living in a country that is less marketized, where there are other sources of value that are taken seriously and treated with reverence. In recent years, the country that has played this role most consistently in the American imagination is Japan. But many Americans who live abroad will find that marketization has wormed its way into the very societies they thought were most impervious to it. Nowhere is safe, and nothing is sacred. If you meet the Italians, they'll sabotage your bike. Now, even the college kids leave school in debt, forced to take whatever jobs they can so they can make their payments on time. The jobs available to them today are no more respectable than the jobs that were available to Dave and his friends. And while retail, food service, and logistics jobs proliferate, politicians pontificate about what a great economy this is. Breaking Away is a great film. It's set in my home state. It makes me feel things. There are so many people I know, and so many more I used to know, in situations even worse than these. Nobody cares. Nobody's doing anything. Everyone who has been lucky enough to get out is intent on normalizing and naturalizing this suffering. But I know these people. There are so many of them with beautiful souls who could do beautiful things if given the chance. But we waste their lives, we ruin them, and then we blame them for the state of the country, for Donald Trump, or Joe Biden, or whichever person has become the avatar of the system that drives men to despair. Anyway, very clearly, this film has me in my feelings. Enough of that. Let's hear from Nina.
Yes, I watching this, I was thinking of you, Benjamin, and imagining, you know, the proximity of the location, the geography. I wondered, maybe we'll talk about this afterwards, how many of the locations you knew or whether they exist now, but in a different form, and you know, how Indiana itself has transformed. I only know Indiana through Eerie Indiana, which I mentioned before, which is a children's TV show, which maybe we should cover at some point. And I really loved this show. It was about paranormal activity, and it was set in Indiana, and it had some very cool young kids in there that were very like esoteric and strange and weird, and it was very, very nice. But that's literally all I know about Indiana, which is nothing. So it was very interesting to watch this film, and it's extremely heartwarming. It's one of the most heartwarming films I've ever seen, and it is extremely moving, and it is extremely you know, as you say, like, I mean, depressing to reflect on the transition between 1979 and 2024. This film came out when I was 1 year old. It depicts an America which looks extremely different today in every respect, in terms of the people who live there, the, you know, as you say, the complete domination of the market. This is a film that depicts life. It's extremely vibrant. It's interesting to compare to Paul Verhoeven's Spetters, which you probably haven't seen. I didn't even know about this film until a couple of weeks ago when someone showed it to me. This is a film from 1980, and it's about motocross rather than cycling. But it has very similar depiction of young male exuberance. It's about a small group of young men who are, you know, rivalrous, hilarious, competitive, competing for girls. The Paul Verhoeven version of this story, set in Holland, is extremely sexualized and quite violent. However, compared to this film, which is largely wholesome, apart from some of the depressing implications around class and ambition and what it means to be trapped somewhere, and all of those kind of thwarted feelings and so on, and who loses and who wins and so on, and really about starting places. And I think this film is very much about where you begin. And I think, you know, it's to note that the working class kids of the cutters, who are not themselves cutters, as you say, because the transmission has been blocked, right? All of the traditions have been curtailed, as you say, and this would also include things like marriage. One of their friends is getting married young, and they go to the registry office, even though the young man doesn't exactly have prospects as you might say, there is a kind of shift in that idea of what marriage is for. It's clear that the other young men are not necessarily interested in marriage, even though people are still getting married quite young at this point in the 70s. My parents got married at 23, and that was totally normal. And I think actually kind of old even for some people. Like people, even when I went to school, some people were getting married like at 16, 17, 18. So the not very many people, admittedly, but it was still a thing. And I think it's much, much, much older now. Like there's been a huge shift. So all of these forms of transmission are diminishing, right? They're declining, whether in terms of labor and occupation and other forms of community, tradition. I can't think of a better word for the moment. But I think this thing about starting points is really important, so that the race becomes a metaphor for class. And it's obviously explicitly about class too, right? These are the local kids coming from behind. They don't have the training, the background, the money, right? Or they don't have the right equipment. They have like homemade t-shirts. Dave's mum makes some t-shirts, very, very cute. But they start in 34th place. They start in last place and they have to work 100 times harder. One of the guys, Dave, takes on by far the burden of the race because he's the true cyclist, the true expert, if you like, in this skill. He spent his, you know, many years presumably practicing and being obsessed with this idea of being an Italian cyclist. And so he's very, very good. The upper class college kids split the labor four ways because they're all presumably equally physically fit. So not only do the working class team start from the last place in the grid, one of them has to work much harder, three or four times harder than everybody else. They get sabotaged. They have terrible equipment. they're looked down upon. All of those sort of obstacles and restrictions, even though Dave wins or the team wins in the end, like it's in the face of multiple types of obstruction, psychic, material, you know, and so on, right? And I think this is a very, very interesting and important kind of metaphor for starting points, like whether we're thinking about education or, you know, life in general. Like it really, really matters where you start, where you're born, who your parents are, how much money you have, how much education, whether you can even get any education, and so on and so forth, right? So I think in that sense, it's a very, very good film about class, both explicitly and implicitly. Like it's quite subtle. It's both a heartwarming film about rivalry and victory and a kind of coming of age of young men and male friendship. And there are lots of films from the 70s and 80s in particular that deal with this genre. Like let's say the four young men have an adventure. Like this is a kind of stock narrative idea. It's very, very well done here. And I think the kind of idiosyncrasies and, like you say, the kind of quixotic or, you know, the almost surreal elements of the characters with the Italian fetish and like the minor details are very, very beautifully done. And I think the dialogue with the young women, it's also like very good, I think, depicting this, you know, the idea of youth as being this time of exuberance and risk and danger. There are many scenes in the film, just as with Spetters, depicts extraordinarily high octane, high energy, exuberant scenes, which are like borderline dangerous, you know, like young men doing things that actually induce almost like a moment of fear. Like, is this person going to seriously hurt themselves? Like there are scenes in the quarry lake. There's a kind of lake that's been artificially created, filling in the quarry, right? Again, as a sort of metaphor for the end of a particular industry. And they swim in this quarry and it becomes this territory. They don't like the college boys swimming there because it's theirs. And they're from Indiana. They're from this place. And these college kids are just there for a few years. They're not really part of it. And yeah, there are these sort of scenes where you're almost like holding your breath, thinking, oh my gosh, you know, this young man is going to brain himself or drown or whatever. But it really reminds you of this time of youth. And maybe youth is also not like that anymore. Like the kind of adventures that people would have in a pre phone era. I mean, people talk about this a lot, this kind of nostalgia. Lots of people talked about Stranger Things in this way, that part of the reason why people loved Stranger Things so much was as a kind of nostalgic fantasy for the image of a world prior to the possibility of tracking somebody all the time or always knowing where people are. And I certainly had a childhood where you could go out and there were no phones and people didn't know where you were. And I grew up in the countryside. I'm sure it's different in different places. There's maybe still a residual idea of trust in places like where I grew up. Like if someone was missing, you could go and find them because you could just ring around the village and everybody more or less knew each other. So there's this idea of community and almost like knowing where to find someone, even if you can't locate them, they don't have a phone. Like there are various obvious places where they might be. And so that idea of trust, I think, is basically kind of gone. And the technology is supposed to have replaced that trust, right? Like, oh, well, it doesn't matter because I know where someone is because they're going to call me. I can geolocate them or whatever. So there's no need, if you like, in some horrible way for social trust or high trust anymore. There's also no need anymore for the kind of pride that's on display here, pride of place, pride of being in Indiana, pride of the race. There's a scene where they, the bicycle race, let's be clear, where they sing the Star Spangled Banner. And it's, you know, there's a kind of effusive love of America, right, in this film. This is a very American film. It's about Indiana, it's about Bloomington, it's about these young men, but it's also about America, right? And a particular image of ultimately fairness, you know, that the best guy will win and it doesn't matter where he comes from. This is what the American dream is in a way. It's like you could be anyone, but if you work really hard, like your work will be rewarded and it will be understood in the context of this ongoing kind of community pride and this kind of national patriotism. You know, even if you have a fetish for Italians, it doesn't matter. Like you're an American, and that's part of being an American as well. And yeah, I thought it was, I never heard of this film. I guess it's probably fairly well known, I suppose. I mean, just a final point, I thought it was also very beautiful in terms of this acknowledgement of like cinema's debt to Italian cinema and to Italian culture as well. Like this is a very beautiful way of sort of saying, you know, look how much we owe to European culture and Italian culture and to Italian cinema. Many films from the 60s and 70s that the director undoubtedly has seen, also dealing with this kind of coming of age of young men and so on, and a certain kind of reverence for beauty and rivalry. And the things that are done here, but they're done in this very American way. And it's very successful. I think it's a really quite lovely film and quite moving. And I agree that it also raises these quite disconcerting questions about where we're at now or where America is at in particular.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about it is that it's not a nostalgic film. It's a film from 1979 about where things are going. It's a film that had a lot to say about what was happening, right? Mm. And now there's all sorts of films and shows that are made that try to get at this in a kind of nostalgic way. But they don't have the sadness to them that this film has, that comes from the fact that it was not written to be nostalgic, but was written to just be a depiction of the unsettled character of the 70s. The sense, I think, that people had that they were stepping over a ledge into some new kind of world that was going to be different. And they had to just have hope that it would be okay and it would work out. That if these working class kids could just figure out how to score high enough on the college entrance exams, they'd be okay. And some of them have a little bit more talent and some of them have it a little bit easier than others because of that. But ultimately, they've all got to figure this out. They've all got to take the college entrance exam or go into the army, which is the other option gestured at in this film. And of course, that has so spectacularly failed everybody. That idea that if everybody just goes to college, then it'll be okay. And yet you could very much see why in 1979 that would be. What else can you do? The quarries are gone. all the jobs that are available to people who don't have a degree are terrible jobs that involve either they don't pay enough or they are not respectable in an important sense. You're not treated with respect working these jobs. There's a scene where one of the kids takes a job at a car wash and his boss just treats him like he's a piece of dirt and tells him, you know, make sure you punch the clock. So he punches it with his fist and walks off the job.
Mm, it's a great scene.
At least the kid has self-respect. Now, these are the jobs that are all over the place, and they're all over the place both for people who go to college and people who don't go to college. Most of the jobs now don't include any dignity for the person working them.
Absolutely. I mean, on the college point, it's interesting to note that even though the father of the cyclist, Dave, who is also, you know, clearly clever, like he clearly gets into he takes the college entrance exam partly as a kind of, you know, rivalrous attempt to prove that he's as intelligent as the people that he's encountered who are on the campus. But there is an initial rivalry between the father and the son as well over the college thing, which I think is important to note, because it's not just the horizontal rivalry or the class rivalry. It's also the kind of patrilineal rivalry, because the father, as you said, very clearly has shifted from being the young, fit quarry guy who had pride and friends to being somebody who's selling cars and having to lie about their status to college students often. And this is humiliating, and he's overweight, and he's sort of has a breakdown temporarily partway through the film. And he's extremely ambivalent about his son going to college initially, because his life is also unfulfilled, right? And he is clearly worried that his son will go too far beyond him, if you see what I mean. And when I speak to my mother about going to university, she was the first person in her family to go, you know, very typically of the post-war boomer generation. My parents were both born just after World War II ended. And the expectation was that she would come back home and look after her parents when she went to university. And she didn't do that. And this was a major issue for her in her life, because nobody really knew how to handle people leaving to go to university at that time. They didn't know what it meant, because it was new at the level that it was occurring. You know, people going on full grants from completely non-academic backgrounds. And my mum got a 2-2 in geography. But she went away, you know, she moved from Bristol to Swansea and had this experience, and she didn't want to go back. And I think this was probably quite devastating for a lot of working class families from that era.
Yes, this class migrant aspect.
Mm.
Yeah. And the mother makes this point when the father's saying, well, what does he need to go to college for? I didn't go.
Yeah.
The mother says, well, he can't go work in the stone quarry either. That's gone. So what do you want him to do? And the father is put in this weird position where he doesn't want his son to do nothing, but he also doesn't want his son to go to college. And it becomes clear that it's college or nothing.
Yeah.
Those are the two options available to the son, really.
Or
and
Chicago.
So the father has to.
Yeah. Or moving away, right?
Yeah.
So Chicago is mooted as this kind of solution to the employment problem. But then again, one of the main boys is talking about how his father can't find a job in Chicago either. So maybe that's not really an option.
It's always imagined that it's better in Chicago. That's a very old fashioned Indiana thing of, well, maybe if you go up to Chicago, things might be different up there.
Mm.
You know, maybe in Chicago. But also Chicago is the place that will suck you into it if you do get the degree. Right. Mm. The girl at the end of the film, her job when she leaves school is going to be in Chicago. Mm. And this is still something that happens in Indiana, where somebody goes to school and they get a good job at the end of it. And it's in Chicago. That is very often still what happens. It's what happens if you can't make it in Indiana. It's what happens if you really do make it in Indiana. You end up sucked into Chicago. Or yeah. Indianapolis, but still more often Chicago.
Yeah. I mean, what about this question I was asking, or this comment about the landscape and the geography? Like, do you recognize Indiana? I mean, I realize that Indiana is probably a massive state. It's probably like twice the size of Britain on its own. Like,
no, Indiana's not that big. It's not twice the size of Britain. No. What it is, if you were to drive from Chicago down to Bloomington, yeah. that's maybe a 3.5 hour drive.
Right.
Right. You know, 2.5 to 3 hours to go from Chicago to Indianapolis. Indianapolis is about dead center in Indiana.
Right.
Right. So Chicago's up at the northwest end. And then Bloomington is maybe halfway between Indianapolis and the southern border with Kentucky, down where you have Evansville and Louisville and the Ohio River and all of that. Right. So going down to Bloomington from Chicago is a trek, but it's something that certainly you can do. You can do it in a day.
Yeah.
If you really wanted to, you could do it as a day trip. But more often than not, if you were to go down to Bloomington, you might stay with somebody, at least for a night.
Right.
If you're coming down from the Chicagoland area.
They
also talk about going to Terre Haute at one point.
Yes.
Terre Haute is further south.
Yes.
And Terre Haute's where Indiana State is, which is another one of our little universities. We've got, in addition to IU, the other big one is Purdue, located in West Lafayette. West Lafayette is about halfway between Chicago and Indianapolis. So if you think about it, as you come down from Chicago, you've got West Lafayette with Purdue, then you've got Indianapolis, then you've got Bloomington, and then you'd have the border with Kentucky. And each of those moves would be about an equal distance down through the state.
Yeah. You've also got a state park named after a potato, which is cool. Do you live in the north bit or in the south bit?
I live in the north bit. So, of course, a lot of friends of mine from school, from high school, went to IU. And when I was an undergrad, I would go down there periodically and hang out with and stay with friends mm-hmm. who were going to IU. It's the more humanities focused of the major Indiana universities. Purdue is more science and math oriented, more engineering.
Mm-hmm. And it's
It's a very beautiful area. Bloomington is one of the nicest natural areas in the state. It's very, very pretty.
Okay.
And the limestone buildings are really gorgeous. Purdue, up for the engineers, it's all brick. Everything is brick where the engineers go. And everything is limestone for the humanities kids down at IU.
Right. Okay. Amazing. And is Notre Dame, it's not the university there, is that? Is that in?
Oh, yes. Yes. Notre Dame is in South Bend. That's where the old Studebaker plant was way back in the day. But of course, Notre Dame is Catholic and private, and you can only go there if you come from a family that's got money. And so it's in a little bit of a different category.
Somebody did ask me once whether you are from the Studebaker family, given your name is Studebaker. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but is it some amazing family?
Well, so way back when, there were five Studebaker brothers, and a couple of them started a company devoted to making wagons, Conestoga wagons. And then eventually that company developed into a car company that made the Studebaker cars. And one of those brothers is, of course, a distant relation of mine. But because there were five brothers when the wagon company started, it's a very large family. It's not as if there's some kind of Studebaker fortune that's... together that has been passed down one to one. That's not how it works. It's a very large family. There's Studebakers all over the place in Indiana.
Oh.
And all over the place in the country too, really. But my father was passionate about cars, and so was his father. And there's always been a great love of the automobile in my family.
Excellent. Well, that explains that. But yeah, like the kind of quarrying and everything, I mean, this is very, it's a depiction not only of the industry, but as you say, also of the kind of natural the land, right? And this kind of territory. And I don't know, like there's something very human about this film. And it's, and one thing I really liked about it was this kind of, even though there was terrible rivalry between the townies, like all the cutters and the people who'd grown up in Bloomington and the college students, when they interacted, even when it was like violently, there's this great scene of a kind of ruckus in a sort of campus-y or university type canteen or cafe where they have a huge big fight. There's still something so humane and because it's face to face, right? Because there is real interaction and a real relation, even if it's rivalrous, that rather than this kind of alienation, whereas I think most college towns now are like very strange. Like I went to, where did I go? Berkeley or whatever, right? And recently, and that this is crazy. What a crazy place. Like people are still wearing masks. It's like super, super liberal and very nice. And, but kind of so passive and so quiet and so, so weird. Like everyone's just in their little world. And I get that studying is a bit like that. And then especially if you're being told that you are investing in your own future. But here you still have this depiction. There's a great scene where the college rector or the vice chancellor or whatever you call them in America calls the students in, like the posh students in, and say after the ruckus, you're not respecting the people who grew up here. You know, and the very idea that a kind of college president or VC could say to his, like have that kind of relation is very unfamiliar to us now.
Yeah, you know, IU students are mainly drawn from all over the state. There is, you know, an out-of-state and international contingent, but for the most part, they're drawn from all over the state.
Okay.
So very few of those students will be from the area around Bloomington, because Bloomington mm-hmm. is not a very large town. Mm-hmm. And a very large portion of the Bloomington population is students or university people. Interestingly, and a lot of people in Indiana don't even know this, Bloomington has some of the highest overall economic inequality of any place in the United States. The working class college distinction is extremely, extremely sharp there. More than other places. And mm-hmm. you wouldn't necessarily think that. You might think, well, it's in the Midwest. It might be more moderate. But no, Bloomington, it's very, very extreme, the gap.
Mm.
Another fun fact is that the term they use in the film, cutters, is not the actual term that was used at IU. That was stonies.
Oh.
But they thought that if they used the word stonies in the film, that people would think it was a reference to marijuana smoking rather than the family occupation. So they changed it to cutters to make it more obvious that it's about stone cutting.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I mean, they could have explained that in the film. I mean, it's like, it wouldn't have been that difficult to make it obvious that that was the reference. But anyway.
I guess in 1979, they didn't want to have to mess about with that. And maybe they just didn't even want the smoke from referencing or appearing to reference marijuana in a major film.
Yeah, no, fair enough, fair enough. I mean, it's a very well done film. I think it's like extremely humane and all of its depictions, right? Like the kind of balance of humor and seriousness. And, you know, the father is very well done as this kind of semi-tragic figure who nevertheless comes to understand his love for his own son and, you know, his own ambitions for his own son. It's very, and the mother is also very subtly drawn as well, I think. You know, she becomes pregnant at the end and is very supportive of her son and her husband, actually, but in quite intricate, complicated ways. Like she knows what's going on, but and she kind of does what she can, but it's in a subtle way because she can't directly confront things.
Yeah, she mediates their relationship. And it's very clear that the father does love him.
Yes.
And the father is upset when he actually gets what he wants and the son gives up the Italian.
Yes.
The father can tell that there's something about his son that has been lost or broken or destroyed in that. And he does have a sadness about it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And yeah, I don't know. It does feel like the end of an era. I mean, it reminded me also, I guess, of a much harder film we watched, but Blue Collar, like the Paul Schrader, in some ways, the depiction of the working class, like what happens to the working class when, it, in a way, crime seems to be the only solution, the only way out, right? Or, you know, giving up on a kind of idea of solidarity, really.
Yeah, that film is, yeah, it's harder and sharper and more antagonistic. This film gets very melancholic in a way that could easily be mistaken for nostalgia, but that's really not what it is. And I think that's the thing about it that's really great.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that point. I think that's a very important point because it isn't therefore like something like Stranger Things, which precisely depended upon this evocation of a nostalgia for a time that probably never really exactly existed, but, you know, involved this kind of BMX-y, Dungeons and Dragons-y fantasy of the endless summer. And, you know, people could tap into some, yeah, lost ideal that they may not have even had or... I agree. And I think it, yeah, that's right. That's what elevates it from mere sentiment and, you know, to something more contemporary, because it is trying to say, like, this is what's happened and this is what's happening. And the future is actually maybe optimistic in some ways, but also uncertain. Like, some people will still stay there and get married. Some people will maybe make it in the town. Some people will go to college. Some people will move away. But some people are going to be losers. I mean, actually, the really tragic character, I suppose, is Mike, I think, one of the four boys, who's in many ways the guy who succeeded at high school. There's reference to him being like a quarterback or something, like being very big on the football team. But in this transitional phase from school to adulthood, which they are in, but they're not having the middle class experience of going through college and professional life. So they're at a loss. And it's Mike, I think, who is the most lost, because he's somebody who was a big deal at school in a sports way, but is now filled with rage and anger, actually, at his increasingly lost opportunities and the increasing lack of status in this world, whether it's through not having a relationship or the rivalry of the college students or not having a job. And he's constantly upset with the other boys if they try to move on. Like the moment they say, oh, I can't go with you to this thing, or I've got something else to do, or I've got to get a job. He's the one trying to keep them with him.
Because he's the one who will be left when they all go. And exactly. He knows it on some level. He's the one who will never go. And he says, you know, there's this scene where he's watching the college football team play, and he talks about how depressing it'll be because he'll get older and older. He'll be 20-year-old Mike, 30-year-old Mike, 40-year-old Mike. And every year there will be new football players who are young and healthy and exuberant. And he will just get older and older and less able to compete with them. And they will continue to perform the role that he wishes he could have performed on some level.
Yeah.
And there's this incredibly moving scene where he tries to race, to have a swimming race with one of the college kids in the quarry. In an attempt to defend the quarry from the college kids, he challenges one of them to a race. And it's his home turf. It's his swimming hole. And he can't keep up. And he tries so, so hard to keep up. And the college kid is effortlessly beating him and starts doing backstroke and starts being very lazy and not even trying very hard. And nonetheless, Mike can't keep up. And he tries so hard, he hits his head against one of the rocks, cuts his head open and begins struggling and has to be rescued by his friends. He's completely humiliated. And it breaks his belief that he really can compete, that he even has value. It makes him start to wonder if maybe the college kids really are better than him.
Mm.
And there's no future promise to Mike in this film.
No. So even the kind of shorter guy who people mock mercilessly because he's not very tall, he has a wife. Like, he clearly has a lovely relationship with this woman, right? So he has a future in that sense, right? I mean, maybe he won't have a very high paying job. He'll always be broke, but they're clearly happy. in, you know, and she's this
somebody
lovely,
loves him at least.
Somebody loves him, and she's like this lovely, pretty local girl, and it's very cute. But yeah, Mike doesn't have that. So he neither has a woman, nor a job, nor a future. And this is really bad, right? Like Mike is, I don't know, like I was thinking today, he'd be the guy who dies of a fentanyl overdose, right? Like,
well, and Dave is doing the bike race at the end of the film for Mike because Mike wants him to do it. And because he realizes that Mike has lost this belief, he's doing it to try to inspire Mike. And when Dave is initially injured in the bike race, they're all expecting Mike to hop on the bike and take over. But Mike is so, his confidence is so shot, he doesn't get on the bike. And the short guy is forced to get on the bike because Mike won't. And it's only after not just the short guy, but also the fourth friend, the guy who is Cyril. Made fun of as being a bit dim.
Yeah.
He gets on the bike, too. And it's only when one of the posh kids rides by and says, "Nice try, guys," that finally Mike works up the courage to get on the bike. And so Mike has this moment where he does get on the bike and he makes an effort and he's able to not just help them keep up, but they're able to gain a little bit of ground with Mike on the bike. But of course, they're not going to win with Mike on the bike. It has to go back to Dave. Even Dave taped onto the bike is, you know, injured, is better than Mike. So what is Mike to do, really?
Yeah.
And the fact that Mike's fate is always present in this film, you are never able to forget what is in store for Mike. It's there at the beginning of the film when they're watching the football players warm up. It's there in the swimming hole scene. And it's there at the end of the film in the race. Mike's fate is the thing about this country that nobody wants to own up to or acknowledge. And this film doesn't let you totally sweep it under the rug. Mm. And that's one of the things I love about this film.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. Like the immediate superficial reading is, oh yeah, this is just a good feel-good film. But the esoteric reading or the implicit reading is, no, this is a film about the present and this is a film about people like Mike. And yeah, I agree. It has this much more profound and unsettling and disquieting and really tragic undertow.
I think people miss this about really heartwarming films. There's films that try to be heartwarming, but really genuinely heartwarming films have to have some kind of melancholic undercurrent to actually be heartwarming in that kind of way. And I mean, I think a lot of people have made inferior films over the years just trying to be heartwarming or trying to capture the positive uplift of something like this. But the only reason that that's there at all is because of the conflict with the melancholic aspect and the bittersweetness of it. That's what makes it so heartwarming. And it's a heartwarmingness that is accompanied by this desire to cry. That's why it's so strong. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe The Holdovers as a recent film also has this strong melancholic aspect of certain lives that are like limited or constrained or cut away from what they want to be. You know, like when people can't flourish because obstacles are in their way. And I think this Dave, the character, when he's cycling in his sort of Italian mode, he almost has accidents constantly. He's constantly almost being hit, but he's able to sort of blithely sail past obstacles. And I think this is also this very beautiful metaphor in a way, like if you feel like you can do anything, then obstacles don't appear like obstacles. You make other people have to get out of your way. But the moment you lose faith and confidence, these obstacles have just become insurmountable. And reading René Girard a lot, because I'm teaching this course on evil, and, you know, Girard is just mind-blowing, really. And not only so, he's one of those theorists that the more you imbibe, the more you see what he's talking about everywhere. So now I see rivalry, and it's impossible for me not to see it in terms of mimetic desire. And but that's not the thing I wanted to mention, which is to do with the idea of the obstacle or the stumbling block. So when René Girard talks about what Satan actually means. It's not this little, you know, dark creature in the history of art as this little sort of demonic figure, but rather Satan is this process, and Satan is a scandal or a stumbling block. It's something that gets in the way of your desire, actually. This is super interesting. This is so not what we think the devil is, right? But this is, and Girard reads it through all of these Bible references. Like, he's not just making it up. Like, he's saying, like, this is actually what's being said. Like, you know, that one of the gospel, oh, who is it? I'm so bad at this stuff, like bibliographic textual memory, but says, you know, Satan, you are a scandal unto me. Like, Satan, you're a stumbling block to me. Right? It's like, well, what does this mean? This is like very, very strange thing to say. Right? But it's like the stumbling block is the thing that gets in the way of your desire. And Satan is this sort of process of temptation, and the idea that encourages all of these kind of negative modes of dealing with your own desire. Because things like envy, whether we're talking about class envy, you know, economic envy, envy over women, right? The idea that, like, oh, some guys get the beautiful girl and you won't get the beautiful girl. And, you know, we've all had an experience of not getting what it is that we want in some ways. Everybody has. But that feeling of envy, whether it's sexual jealousy or, you know, status envy, oh, why did this person get published and I didn't? And I know I've been subject to that, like feeling it, but also receiving that envy from other people in different contexts. Getting a job, when I got the academic job, lots of people were very upset with me because they wanted it, I guess, because it was a very competitive thing to get. And how to put it, but these feelings of envy and rivalry, which are based on the fact that we emulate each other's desire, and actually the truth of desire is that we're more or less, we have similar desires, like our desire is quite similar. And this is one of the problems. We don't compete for vastly different things. We compete for the same things, especially in a competitive system like the capitalist system. We're competing with each other constantly for work and attention and whatever. But these feelings are so unpleasant that we bury them and we give them another name because we can't cope. It's too difficult to say in reality, actually, I'm suffering from serious sexual jealousy because I don't think you should be going out with this person. I think you should be going out with me. Like, nobody can say that, or they might be able to, but it's extremely rare. We would rather lie to ourselves and to other people than admit these very, very, very unpleasant feelings. And I think this film does this great job of depicting the difficulty of dealing with those feelings of rivalry, unfairness, injustice, and how people try to cope with them. And Mike is especially well depicted in this way, I think.
I think the father, too.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Because one of the ways that people cope with humiliation is by retreating into pride, right? When you're humiliated, that's when you've got to have pride, because pride is the thing that stops you from completely going into the abyss. And in that way, humiliation forces pride, and then pride becomes an obstacle to dealing with.
Exactly. And pride is the greatest
thing that causes humiliation.
Exactly. And you know, pride is the greatest sin because it's the gateway to all the others. Right. So pride and Satan is also this figure of pride, right? Because, you know, if you think about the competition with God, it's like, I don't want to serve God. I want to be the rival of God. Right. So pride is what causes all of the falls, like whether it's Lucifer or humanity. And then when the kind of medieval theologians talk about pride, or is it superbia in Latin? What are the older terms for pride? Is it superbia? I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Or hubris, right? In the Greek, the ancient Greek, it's hubris.
Right.
Yeah. But so superbia, hubris, pride, like, because it implies that one knows better, right? That one thinks one knows better. Then it's the gateway to all the other ones. Oh, I think I can eat as much as I want because I won't get fat. I don't know.
Right. But part of what makes it so nasty, right, is that not only can it be a gateway to these other things, it can also be the thing that you use to try to protect yourself from other vices.
Exactly.
Right? It's the father's pride in the face of being humiliated and forced to become a used car salesman that prevents him from, say, just descending into alcoholism and becoming a total wreck of a person.
Yeah.
He does overeat a bit, but only a bit, because this pride allows him to maintain some level of dignity while he is in this humiliated position. And so humiliation creates a pride which both unlocks other vices and protects us from other vices. So it becomes this trap that we get stuck in. And I think that insofar as the father, Mike and the father are, I think, the two figures in this film that are indicative of where we're all going and what we're all becoming. And they're both humiliated characters that are forced to retreat into pride as a way of carrying on.
Wow.
And I think that's all of American culture. It's people who have been humiliated and forced to retreat into pride.
Yeah. That is a very depressing insight. And I guess pride, especially, you know, because it's I mean, this is why the Christian solution, like humility, is so interesting, because it seeks to solve the problem of pride, if you like, by, you know, when you say the meek shall inherit the earth, the last shall be first, and all of those things. And of course, like, the Nietzschean criticism immediately comes to mind. This is slave morality, blah, blah, blah. But I do think as a solution to the problem of pride, because pride is so fragile precisely in this way, and pride is exactly that which leads to violence. I mean, if you think about those situations where, like, men are at a bar and they're a little bit drunk, and very common trope of thinking that somebody is looking at you, or, you know, looking at your bird, or, you know, has taken your pint, and there's a kind of immediate rivalry and desire to assert oneself. You get it in Hegel as well, with the kind of battle of the consciousness and self-consciousness trying to eliminate the other, is one stage of the process. But it's so fragile, because it's like saying my sense of self depends upon a combative attitude towards you, and even a desire or an attempt to destroy you. But of course, the destruction of the other then eliminates the possibility of recognition. Yeah, because you can't be recognized by a defeated enemy.
Well, and because it's humiliation itself which fuels this, the moments where you most need humility are when you are being pushed toward pride. But it's hardest to have humility when you're undergoing humiliation. And part of what used to make it easier for working class people to not feel humiliated is that they had spaces, organizations, places that were theirs. And all of these things are taken from them. And in this film, the, you know, the quarry, the swimming hole itself, is taken from them. The school, you know, the university that they build, after they build it, they don't feel welcome in it. These humiliations are constantly visited upon them. And yet there's this demand that they have humility in the face of humiliation, which is so, so challenging. That's such a difficult thing, even for people in the best of circumstances, to pull off. And I think that part of what the culture industry does is it tries to find ways to subject people to humiliation. You know, so many ads are about trying to make you feel humiliated by the way you look, or, you know, and a lot of sitcoms in the 90s and 2000s were just built on humiliation. All the jokes are humiliation jokes to make various characters feel humiliated, to make various people who are watching the show feel humiliated by proxy, realize that they're like the characters who are being made fun of in various ways. A society that is completely infused with humiliation is a society that is really going to struggle to resist pride.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's so difficult, because the proximity between being humble or being meek and being humiliated is so close. This is also the problem. I mean, Girard makes this point that Satan is not distant, right? This process is extremely proximate to the good version of it, if you see what I mean. Like, they're not dissociable. And he says that, look, if Satan was, the process was purely destructive, then everything would have been destroyed a long time ago. But it's not purely destructive. It's also, like, profoundly creative. and that this process actually generates an awful lot of things like action and so on. But I agree. I mean, when you look at kind of adverts, I mean, for so long now, like especially men, the way men are depicted in adverts is like just idiots, you know, oh, this man doesn't even know how to like clean an oven, or like this man is just useless and a loser. And like in a family, what is the role of this stupid dad? You know, and this is like, this is not accidental, right? These forms of representation are profoundly meaningful, and they have real effects on people. Like we think it's just stupid. Oh, what? Who cares? It's just an advert, blah, blah, blah. But we know how affected people are by models. And this is the other thing Gerard talks about, like the model. Like, because we're so profoundly mimetic, we copy models. And so the models that we have are extremely important, because they're precisely, you know, whether it's Andrew Tate or Jordan Peterson or men on the TV, right? The kind of humiliation you're talking about is transmitted through the culture precisely, as you're saying. And in a way, then it becomes like almost a default mode of being, like to be humiliated, you know. And it's not being humble. It's not being humble in the face of God, or loving thy neighbor, or not being avaricious or prideful or any of the sinful things. It's just being beaten down. It's being kind of evacuated of any subjective power, right? You're kind of destituted by humiliation.
Yeah. And then in this situation, any relief from this condition is welcomed and is treated as if it salvages you. So representation in an ad of someone who doesn't look like the standard model can be mistaken for something emancipatory when you're subject to so much psychic humiliation so often. I think this is in part why so many people love the Michael Cera Cerave ad during the Super Bowl, where Michael Cera goes, you know, I'm Michael Cera and this is my cream. Let my cream hydrate you. This ad completely blew up in the States, because here's Michael Cera, a guy who's got this patchy facial hair, this guy who plays Alan in Barbie, this misfit guy, and he's at the center of an ad for a cream. It's not some kind of model looking guy. It's Michael Cera. And here he is, you know, in a Super Bowl ad of all things.
Actually,
for this hydrating cream.
It's so interesting that you mentioned him, because I was thinking in some very not quite fully formed way that the main character, Dave, in this film is very much like Michael Cera. He looks like him. He has a similar kind of physique and a similar, you know, almost character, actually. I mean, Michael Cera tends towards playing more losers types in a way, but like in Arrested Development and so on. But there's also something kind of very sublime about Michael Cera. I mean, he's a fantastic actor.
It's so easy to see in Michael Cera the overcoming of humiliation for a certain kind of guy.
Right. But that's so interesting, isn't it? And do you think he is a bit like the Dave character? Like Dave super reminded me of Michael Cera, actually. As a
kind of lanky, a little bit weird, perfectly happy and content to be weird, not bothered about being weird, not embarrassed by being weird. If anything, wearing it on his sleeve as his... personal thing. I think this is one of the most powerful ideological tools that American culture still has, is the image of the Michael Cera, the person who has all the disadvantages superficially, but nonetheless has overcome them. You know, for Michael Cera, it's physical disadvantages. He's, you know, skinny and lanky and boyish and all
but
of that.
But he does
and
often
yet, here
get,
he is. He's
get
the
a
model.
Girl. He often gets a girl, right? In many of the films and series, like ultimately he gets a girl somehow.
Yes, because Michael Cera's triumph is this, oh, but you can nonetheless succeed. Mm. You can nonetheless succeed. You can be Michael Cera.
But is this like a kind of false hope though, you know?
Yes, of course it is. And that's why it's so compelling, because it is precisely the thing people are looking for, is this image of somehow it will work out. And so the Dave Stoller, the Michael Cera, it's contrasted in this film with Mike and with the dad. And that's what's great about it. That's what I love about that. Because it to make this film as successful as it was, for it to win, you know, best screenplay, which it did, for 1979, It had to have, you know, this uplift in it, but the its capacity to undercut that uplift in such deep and moving ways is what makes it such a powerful film and what makes it so great. And I think a lot of people who view this film will miss these elements. But it's why it's such a beautiful film. Well, the real reason why you feel what you feel when you watch it.
Yeah. I mean, they won't miss these elements if they listen to this episode of The Lack, though, so.
Good. I do hope listeners who haven't seen this film do see it. It was recommended to me by one of our listeners. That was why I picked it. And I'm very grateful for the recommendation. It was a wonderful way to spend a couple hours. So thank you guys so much for listening. We're going to go to the B-side now. Have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Bye.